Chapter 63. Sabotage. It was nearly noon on November the 21st, 1903, when the superintendent of the Vindicator Silver Mine, Cripple Creek, Colorado, set out on a routine check of the mine with his shift boss. They were walking cautiously. For the past 3 months there had been constant trouble at the mine. The miners were on strike, the National Guard had been called in, and the night watchman had seen shadowy figures wandering around. The two men reached the sixth level, and Charles McCormick gripped a handrail to steady himself. The sound of a revolver shot made them both fling themselves backwards, and then there was a tremendous roar. The mine collapsed around them, killing them both. Later, in the wreckage, investigators found the remains of a twisted revolver. Its trigger had been attached to the handrail with a fishing line, so that when anyone grasped the shaky rail, a bullet was fired into a bundle of dynamite sticks. The Cripple Creek mine explosion was one of the first acts of industrial sabotage in American history. But in those days it wasn't known as sabotage. The word only came into general use after a French railway strike of 1912, when the railwaymen put their wooden shoes, or sabots, onto the railway lines in order to wreck the trains. But sabotage, or industrial wrecking, had been preached by trade union organisations for more than 50 years. The first recorded instance of it occurred when Sheffield workers destroyed the tools of blacklegs or strikebreakers in the 1860s. The Cripple Creek mine explosion was not quite the first piece of industrial sabotage in American history. As early as 1892, there had been a clash between union and non-union miners at the Frisco mine at Gem, Idaho. 15 men died in the fight when the strikers blew up the mine. Again, in 1899, a gang from Burke, Idaho, blew up the Bunker Hill Sullivan mine at Wardner in Idaho. These cases were not, perhaps, sabotage in the modern sense, but an explosion that occurred soon after the Cripple Creek incident was. On June the 6th, 1904, 26 non-union men from a mine at Independence, Colorado, were standing on the platform at a train depot after finishing their day's work. A sudden explosion turned the depot into matchwood, killing 14 of the men and seriously injuring the rest. Some were crippled for life. On November the 17th, 1904, Fred Brantley, ex-manager of the Bunker Hill Sullivan mine, walked into the hall of his San Francisco home and lit a cigar. The next moment a discharge blew him straight out of the door. Although seriously injured, he recovered, and the San Francisco Gas Company subsequently paid him nearly $11,000 in damages, assuming the explosion to have been a faulty gas main. On December the 30th, 1905, Frank Steunenberg, the ex-governor of Idaho, opened his garden gate and was hurled into the air by a blast of dynamite. His wife rushed out to find the snow stained with blood and her husband, unrecognisable, dying. The police acted quickly. All the roads out of the city were closed and the hotels were searched. And they were in luck. The proprietor of the Saratoga Hotel thought that one of his guests had been acting suspiciously, and when the police called the next day, the man was still there. In his room, the police found potassium chlorate and other explosive ingredients. He was a small, cheerful-looking Irishman with a round, red face, and he gave his name as Harry Orchard. Many people at the time recorded the impression that he didn't want to get away, that he sought out the notoriety and the publicity that he felt were his due. And he got them. He confessed to a whole series of crimes. He had personally lit the fuse that blew up the Bunker Hill Sullivan mine. He had planted the dynamite and the revolver in the Cripple Creek mine. He had planted the bomb that blew up the railway station at Independence. He had blown up Governor Steunenberg and Fred Bradley. The explosion that blew Bradley out of his own front door was not gas. It was pure coincidence that it took place as he lit a cigar. Having got himself arrested, Harry Orchard, whose real name was Albert Horsley, proceeded to wriggle his neck out of the hangman's noose. The first thing that he did was to implicate several leaders of the Western Federation of Miners Union, including William Haywood, George Pettibone and Charles Moyer. He then had a religious revelation, and he declared himself to be a reformed man who had seen the light. He told reporters smugly that he had believed he was engaged in a class war, but that since God had enlightened him, he realised that he had only been seeking revenge. His plan worked. He was sentenced to life imprisonment, and subsequently became a Seventh-day Adventist and a leading preacher in the penitentiary. But if Orchard's conversion was unworthy of a revolutionary, his methods were an inspiration to Labour saboteurs the world over. At the Independence Railroad depot, 100 pounds of dynamite had been placed under the floor. Detonating caps were placed on top of the dynamite, and then above them, attached to a small wheel, was a bottle of sulfuric acid. A long wire fixed to the wheel meant that the acid could be tilted onto the caps at any time. Orchard was several hundred yards away when he tugged the wire that sent the station sky high. He had got into Fred Bradley's home by becoming the lover of one of his servant girls. He used the same device, the sulfuric acid, on a kind of windlass. This time, however, the wire was attached to the door, so that the dynamite would explode when the door was opened. The same dynamite and acid bottle device was used to blow up Governor Frank Steunenberg. There's one interesting point about Orchard's long confession. For all its pious expression of repentance for his crimes, it's obvious that he enjoyed every minute of his strange manhunts. He had discovered a new sport that combined the adult's love of hunting with the child's delight in causing loud bangs. It's a characteristic that appears in many saboteurs. In spite of Orchard's confessions, the accused union leaders managed to escape, largely due to the brilliant efforts of the great advocate Clarence Darrow. Darrow became the hero of the American labour movement, and Pettibone, Moyer and the rest were regarded as near martyrs. In retrospect, it seems more than likely that the union leaders were accessories. They were fortunate in that America's greatest criminal lawyer chose to defend them. America suddenly discovered the full meaning of sabotage during World War I. The United States had a high population of immigrant Germans, many of them American citizens. Even before the United States entered the war in April of 1917, it was supplying England with arms and food. And then the explosions began. It was on a hot June evening in 1916 that a guard in the great freight yards of Black Tom, that's the promontory of New Jersey that faces New York, was startled to see a fire burning underneath a railroad wagon loaded with munitions. Then he saw another fire 100 yards away. He rang the fire alarm, but a quarter of an hour later, tremendous explosions sent a column of smoke and fire into the air. The whole freight yard, full of munitions for the Allies, went off like a giant bomb. The concussion was enough to have destroyed the skyscrapers of Wall Street, but the force of the blast went upwards. Only 2 adults and a child were killed. A landlady subsequently reported that her lodger, a Hungarian named Michael Christoph, had been pacing his room all night after the explosion, groaning, "What have I done?" An American agent actually got an admission of guilt out of Christoph, and then Christoph disappeared. Ironically, he had been arrested for a civil offence and put in jail, where he stayed for the duration of the war. On the other side of the country, in San Francisco, a German reported to the authorities that he had heard of a plot to blow up the Mare Island Navy Yard. Before the authorities could act, the yard erupted in flames and suffered explosions as violent as those at Black Tom. This time, 16 children were among the dead. The solution of the Mare Island explosion came by chance after the outbreak of war in 1917. Although Mexico was neutral, there was much anti-Americanism there, and the Mexican police made no attempt to harass Germans who were obviously spies. Washington persuaded Paul Altendorf, a colonel in the Mexican army, to act as a counter-spy. In Mexico City bars, Altendorf made the acquaintance of Kurt Janka, who was suspected of being an enemy agent. Janka was a heavy drinker, and one day, in a confiding mood, he told Altendorf that he was the patriotic citizen who had reported the plot to blow up Mare Island to the authorities, and also the man who had then blown it up. He had reported it because he knew that he would then be the last person to be suspected of the explosion. Janka was an explosives expert who worked in combination with Lothar Witzke, another of Germany's most skilled saboteurs. Altendorf, pretending to be as anti-American as Janka, offered his aid in future projects. Janka said that Witzke needed help finding his way back across the Mexican border into the United States. Altendorf said that he knew the country intimately and would be glad to help. The consequence was that when Witzke arrived at Nogales, Arizona, he found American Secret Servicemen waiting to arrest him. He was subsequently sentenced to death, but reprieved and later allowed to return to Germany. The end of the Witzke-Janka team was one of the triumphs that helped to put a stop to sabotage in World War I. The other was the capture of the beautiful German spy Maria von Kretschmann. This was due to a fortunate accident. A courier put two letters into the wrong envelopes. On the advice of British intelligence, American agents were already watching an address on Long Island. A letter was duly intercepted, and the agents were puzzled. The envelope was addressed to a man, one of the German agents that they were on the lookout for, but the letter inside was to a woman. Chemical technicians tested the letter and found another letter on the back written in invisible ink. It was about the blowing up of munitions factories and mines. With excitement, the agents realised that they had stumbled on a key figure in the sabotage network. But who was she? They traced the courier who had sent the letter. He had put his return address on the envelope, a sailor's lodging house, but that didn't help them much either. The man was simply a go-between who had agreed to post the two letters when he landed in New York. It was he who had removed the letters from their grubby old envelopes and, in readdressing them, had put them back in the wrong envelopes. He could even recall the address on the other envelope, but again the agents were frustrated. An old lady who lived there said that she sometimes received letters for someone else, but she couldn't give any more information, except that she had once seen the name Victoria on one of them. That didn't seem much to go on. The agents managed to find another cache of unopened Victoria letters at another post-restaurant address, but again, the trail led nowhere. All they proved was that Victoria was involved in the series of explosions that were rocking American factories and dockyards every other week. The Secret Service then deployed dozens of agents to watch every person mentioned in the letters. They maintained their surveillance for weeks, and no one did anything suspicious. One weary agent reported to his chief that the young sister of one of the suspects seemed to be very religious. She never missed going to church. His chief looked up sharply. "Well, in that case, follow her, you fool!" His intuition proved to be correct. The next day, the agent saw the young girl kneel down in St. Patrick's Cathedral in Fifth Avenue and place a newspaper on the seat. When she left, the newspaper was still there. Another man moved into the pew, prayed briefly, and then left, carrying the newspaper. The man went to a Long Island hotel, the Nassau, and he sat there in the lounge for a few minutes. And then he walked out, leaving the newspaper behind. A tall, beautiful blonde woman in her 30s then sat down and casually picked it up. A few days later, the elusive Madame Victoria was under arrest. Her real name was Maria von Kretschmann. Under interrogation, she confessed and told the agents how she had used religion to aid her activities as a key saboteur. She persuaded Catholic priests to help her in ordering religious statuettes from Zurich in Switzerland. When the statuettes arrived, they would be full of chemicals vital to the detonating of explosives. The nervous strain had been telling on her. Now that she was arrested, she cracked, and she died, a drug addict, a few years later. With her capture and the breakup of the Yankovitska partnership, the United States had eliminated the sabotage ring that had been causing so much damage. The damage might have been far worse if one of Germany's master spies and saboteurs had not been hamstrung by jealousy from bureaucrats at home. Franz Rintelen von Kleist, usually known simply as von Rintelen, got into the United States on a Swiss passport in the month America declared war. His speciality was sabotage. A German-American, Dr. Schley, had invented a new incendiary device, no bigger than a fountain pen. It was divided in half by a thin copper wall. One half contained picric acid and the other half sulfuric acid. When the sulfuric acid ate through the copper, a brilliant hot flame shot out of the device. It was called a thermite pencil. Von Rintelen contacted Schley, arranged for the manufacture of hundreds of thermite pencils, and then passed them on to Irish dock workers who hated the British and who dropped them into cracks on munition ships about to depart for England. Soon there were fires at sea, and the British realised that a new master saboteur was at work. Another German inventor named Fay produced a kind of bomb that would explode as the rudder of a ship moved from side to side. It was attached by a magnet, like a modern limpet mine. The mysterious fires at sea were then supplemented by mysterious explosions that destroyed the ship's rudder. But von Rintelen's brilliance was his own undoing. Congratulatory messages came from high sources in the Fatherland and passed through the Washington Embassy. Jealousies and resentments flared. To von Rintelen's alarm, the men who should have been protecting him began to commit indiscretions. One day he actually received a letter addressed to him with his correct name. He was under an alias, naturally, and his military title. As American agents closed in, he slipped on board a ship. All might have been well, but the ship stopped at Southampton, and although his passport said that he was a Swiss citizen, von Rintelen was questioned. Suddenly the interrogator tried an old trick. He yelled in German, "Salute!" and von Rintelen's heels automatically clicked together. Even then he succeeded in escaping from custody and was finally captured in Leicester. The great British spy himself, Admiral Blinker Hull, took advantage of his resentment about the German embassy to get him to cooperate with British intelligence. The man who could have been Germany's top saboteur of World War I was turned into a traitor by the petty envy and jealousy of his superiors. The greatest saboteur of all time was also a German, although he devoted his life to working for Soviet Russia. Ernst Friedrich Vollweber was born in 1898, the son of a Hamburg miner. He was short, chunky, ugly, and driven by an immense energy. And later in life, he was to become an obese dwarf. It may have been some desire to compensate for his unattractive appearance that turned Vollweber into a revolutionary. In 1917, he joined the German Navy. Inspired by the Russian Revolution, he preached socialism below the decks. It was Vollweber's propaganda that helped stir the German fleet to mutiny in November 1918, and he personally hauled up the red flag on the cruiser Heligoland at the entrance to the Kiel Canal, the signal for the revolt. In Bremen, Vollweber led rioters on the Oslobausen prison, and he saw the prisoners set free. He hoped for a swift communist triumph in Germany, but he was disappointed. Even in defeat, Germany was not ready for revolution. The Weimar Republic was formed in 1919, and Vollweber responded by leading another mutiny on board ship, and he took the vessel to Murmansk as a present for the Soviet regime. As a reward for this, he was appointed by Lenin as chairman of the International Seamen's Union. He sailed around the world, acting as an emissary for communism in China, Japan, Italy, and in the United States. The communists were shocked by the ease with which Hitler destroyed the German Communist Party when he came to power in 1933, but Vollweber was typically undismayed. He chose Copenhagen as his headquarters, and he settled down to a career as a master saboteur. Ships left Denmark loaded with supplies for the fascists in the Spanish Civil War. Vollweber's agents mixed TNT with the coal, and many of the ships failed to reach the Spanish ports, or had their cargoes destroyed by fire. One of Vollweber's great triumphs was the destruction of the German troopship Marion, which left Denmark for Norway in 1940. A shattering explosion sank the ship, and badly burned corpses floated ashore for weeks afterwards. 4,000 of them. When the Nazis invaded Denmark, Vollweber moved to Sweden. Although he was promptly arrested, he had already succeeded in organising a sabotage ring there. His agent, Jacob Liebeshorn, had recruited two young waitresses, Erika Müller and Gunhild Achmann. They were ideal agents. No one suspected two women. They were responsible for the explosion that destroyed part of the freight yards at Krullbu in central Sweden on July the 19th, 1941, and detonated truckloads of German shells. There were many more fires and explosions before the counter-espionage branch of the Swedish Statspolisen arrested the two women and their accomplices and sent them to prison. The Swedes kept Vollweber in jail until the end of the war, in spite of Nazi demands that he be handed over. As soon as it was clear that the Nazis were losing the war, however, they allowed Vollweber to go to Moscow. There he was treated as a Soviet hero and entered Berlin not far behind Marshal Zhukov. Declining important political appointments, he went back to organising an East German spy ring. He enjoyed undercover work. He may also have felt that a public appointment would restrict his sex life, for he was known as an insatiable satyr. Again, there were explosions on British and American ships. The fire on the Queen Elizabeth in 1953 was almost certainly Vollweber's work, but that was one of his last achievements in sabotage. In that year, he was appointed Minister of State Security in East Germany. There was a point in 1961 when it looked as if Vollweber's luck was at last running out. After a clash with Walter Ulbricht, the secretary of the East German Communist Party ordered Vollweber's arrest. Vollweber contacted Moscow, and a telegram arrived saying, "Let Vollweber alone, he is a friend of mine." It was signed Khrushchev. And so Vollweber died of natural causes in 1962. It's a fate of the saboteur to live in an emotional no-man's land, with no place that he can openly call his own. His existence and his psychological condition is one of constant uncertainty, fear and suspicion. He's like a man who has betrayed his wife and the mistress whom he has set in her place. He is his own worst enemy.